Thank you very much, Chuck. I think we're going to get some new slides loaded up here while we're waiting. I do want to thank RFA, thank Bob, thank Chuck for inviting me to speak here and recognize the close, collaborative, and constructive relationship we've had with Bob and RFA and many, many people in this room in developing the rule that I'm going to talk about. We really appreciate it, and it's clearly led to a better rule. The other thing I just want to mention, Chuck mentioned my Midwestern roots, and I will say that due to the 3 feet of snow we've gotten in Washington, D.C. over the last couple weeks, it feels a lot closer to where I grew up in Minnesota than it does in any of the last 12 years I've spent in Washington, D.C. Okay, so I am incredibly happy to be here because this is such a great group, such a good relationship we've got, and we've learned so much by working with RFA. But also particularly because I am able to stand here and say that the final renewable fuel standard 2 rules were signed 2 weeks ago. We weren't entirely sure exactly when that was going to happen, but I can tell you that nobody is happier than those of us who've been working on the rules for the last several years to have them finally issued in its final form. Now, that being said, we know there's a long road ahead. There's still a lot of work to be done. There's an ongoing process, and we know we're going to have to keep relying on this relationship we have developed with RFA and with its members to keep the work moving forward and keep improving the rules, making sure that they're implemented correctly, and adding to this, because we've issued this final rule a couple weeks ago, we know that we're going to have to go through annual rulemakings to keep carrying out various different pieces of it. Okay, so I'm going to just talk a little bit more in detail along the lines of what Chuck laid out. I will talk about the key changes that were required by the Energy Independence and Security Act, and then talk a little bit about what the 2010 standards were, because in addition to laying out the full structure for this rule going forward to realize the full renewable fuel volumes required by the Energy Independence and Security Act, we also have to set the actual annual volume standards. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about what we did just for 2010. Then there's a couple sort of key provisions, some of which have been more controversial than others, and I'm going to flag a little bit in those areas on what we've done, particularly talking a little bit about the renewable biomass provisions, as well as then diving a little bit more into the life cycle results and the changes that went on there between proposal and final, and I know Bob has already mentioned those a little bit. And then I'm just going to end by talking a little bit about the impacts of the rule, because there's no question that putting these rules out is a significant step towards achieving the economic, energy, and environmental benefits envisioned by Congress when they passed the Energy Independence and Security Act. And so I just want to talk a little bit about some of those impacts that we've analyzed. Okay. So what are the key changes required by ISA? The biggest thing, obviously, is that it significantly increased the renewable fuel volumes required in this country up to 36 billion gallons by 2022. The other thing it did is it actually, instead of having one volume category, separated the total renewable fuel volumes into 4 separate categories of renewable fuel. A total renewable fuel category, an advanced biofuel category, and then within that advanced biofuel category, a cellulosic biofuel, as well as a biomass-based diesel standard. It also, as I mentioned, the Act made changes to the definition of renewable fuels that included setting minimum life cycle greenhouse gas reduction thresholds for each of the volume categories. There also, in the Act, were restrictions on the types of feedstocks that could be used to make renewable fuel. And we did a fair amount of work in this area, and I'll talk a little bit about where we ended up. The statute also included several specific types of waivers, as well as an EPA-generated credit for cellulosic biofuel. And those are important provisions that we should recognize, and that our rules laid out how we would plan to implement them. Okay, there we go. So I think this is probably not news to anybody, but let me just make sure we sort of laid it all out so that we're all on the same page. With these four separate standards that I mentioned, there's a biomass-based diesel standard, which goes up to about 1 billion gallons by 2012 and beyond. So this, in other words, it can be met through biodiesel, renewable diesel, but all of the fuels that want credit for this standard have to meet a minimum 50% life cycle greenhouse gas threshold. There is also a separate cellulosic biofuel standard, which goes up to about 16 billion gallons by 2022. So renewable fuel has to be produced from cellulosic materials. Fuel in this category has to meet a 60% life cycle greenhouse gas threshold. And again, everything I'm walking through here is actually in the statute. It's one of those areas that was very clear in the statute, then the details of which, of course, were left up to EPA to implement and interpret through our rulemaking. Then there's an advanced biofuel category, really, which is made up of both the cellulosic biofuel category as well as the biomass-based diesel standard. And that, in total, would add up to about 21 billion gallons by 2022. And then, again, that advanced biofuel category is nested within the total renewable fuel, which is a total of 36 billion gallons by 2022, which, and then if you take the difference between the advanced biofuel category and the total renewable fuel, it goes up to about 15 billion gallons of additional fuel that is not in that advanced biofuel category. This next point just shows, again, these different nested categories, the different volume standards, and what it shows is where the increases come from. You can see that there's an increase. The bottom is really what we consider this total renewable fuel category beyond what's in the advanced biofuel category, and we think it's largely going to be met through conventional biofuel, and that goes up to that 15 billion gallons or so. And then you can see beyond that, it's really the advanced biofuel, and particularly the cellulosic biofuel category, that starts to increase fairly significantly and rapidly until it goes up to the 16 billion gallons in 2022. Okay, so that's what's in the statute. So now what did EPA do in working through its rule? And again, all of these things are aspects that we proposed when we proposed the original Renewable Fuel Standard 2 rule back in May of last year. We laid out these provisions. We took comment on a number of options for how we were going to interpret this, and then went through a public comment period. Many of the places that we ended up in the final rule were, in fact, what we had ended up proposing in the proposal, but not all of them. There are several aspects that we did move off of where we had originally proposed last May when we finalized the rule 2 weeks ago, and I'll flag where some of those areas were that we moved between proposal and final. So the first thing to note is that for 2010, we finalized applying the Energy Independence Security Act RFS 2 standards for all of 2010. So in other words, we are implementing the full 2010 volumes of 12.95 billion gallons. We believe this is the most straightforward interpretation of the act. While it's true, because the rules were final 2 weeks ago and we have to have a 60-day congressional review period, the regulations themselves for RFS 2 will not go into effect until July 1st. The RFS 1 regs still apply between January and June, and therefore we think we can implement the full 2010 volumes. So while the definitional changes, some of the implementation details that change between the original renewable fuel standard rules and the second renewable fuel standard rules, those will change on July 1st. The volumes themselves that we're implementing through this program are the full 2010 volumes for all of the different renewable fuel categories. This means that there will be both Renewable Fuel Standard 1 and Renewable Fuel Standard 2 renewable identification numbers, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with this. This is the term we apply to every gallon produced in this country gets assigned this renewable identification number in the distribution system for purposes of tracking and compliance with the program. This would have happened, so we're going to have both these RFS 1 RINs as well as the RFS 2 RINs in the system this year. This would have happened regardless of whether the actually implementation of the rules went into effect January 1st or July 1st, since the RINs from the first program are already in the marketplace and have a 2-year life. That being said, we understand that this is going to be a transition and that there are going to be two different forms of these RINs floating around in the system. And so the final rule had to incorporate provisions to provide for this transition. The RFS1 RINs are valid under RFS2 and will be applied towards the separate standards based on the codes that are inherent within the RIN system. The RFS2 RINs will have distinct codes to differentiate them so that we will be able to tell and you will be able to tell the difference between the RFS1 and the RFS2 RINs. And then the final point about the system for 2010 is that the final rule maintains the ethanol equivalent energy-based approach for the Renewable Fuel Standard 2, which was the approach taken in the first Renewable Fuel Standard. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the specific numbers for 2010. So as I said, we are applying the full 2010 RFS2 standard volumes of 12.95 billion gallons. Then for each of the different subcategories, I'll talk through the approach. For the biomass-based diesel standard, we actually proposed last May that when we implemented it for 2010, we would combine the 2009 biodiesel volumes with the 2010 requirement. And that is, in fact, what we have done with this final rule. So the final rule takes the 2009 half a billion gallon biomass-based diesel requirement, adds it to the 2010 0.65 billion gallon requirement. Again, those numbers are both out of the statute, and implements that full volume for 2010. That means that all the biodiesel RINs that were used for compliance in 2009 and generated in 2009 count towards the standard. And the 2008 and 2009 biodiesel RINs that were not used for compliance in 2009 can count towards the standard, subject to some rollover provisions that are in the Act, that are in the final rule. The cellulosic standard, we set a 2010 standard for 6.5 million gallons. Now, this is a change from the proposal. In the proposal, we proposed that in 2010 we would implement the full volumes that were envisioned in the Act of 100 million gallons. Based on new information, based on the projections from EIA, based on reports we've gotten from the industry, we have decided to set the 2010 volume standard at 6.5 million gallons. As the Act gives us that flexibility and in fact requires us to set that on an annual basis, notwithstanding what is in the Act, the Act actually tells us, EPA, you have to set for each subsequent year what that cellulosic volume standard should be based on existing information, based on EIA projections, et cetera. And so that's what we've done for 2010. And that's what we would have to do every year subsequently. Now, we do recognize that this is a lower number than what is in the Act, but we're also very hopeful and optimistic that as we move forward, as the industry develops further, and as these rules are in place providing more certainty for investments, that the volumes will come up and we'll be able to realize going forward what the volumes are in the statute. And then the final standard that we actually have to set is the total advanced standard, which we've maintained at 0.95 billion gallons. We think in 2010 that will be met through the biomass-based diesel compliance, again, because each of the biomass-based diesel as well as the cellulosic standards are nested underneath this advanced biofuel category. The biomass-based diesel standard, realizing it, will actually satisfy, in addition, the total advanced standard for 2010. So this just summarizes what I just walked through, the 6.5 million gallons of cellulosic biofuel. The biomass-based diesel standard is 1.15 billion gallons, again, which is the adding the 2009 plus the 2010 volumes together, the remaining total advanced biofuel, and then the total renewable fuel ends up being 12.95. All right, I'm going to shift and talk a little bit more about some of the specific provisions. And I'm going to highlight the ones where we got the most comment on, where we understand that there was the most discussion and that we really felt were very critical in terms of both our interpretation of the Act as well as what folks really cared a great deal about. So the first one specific, one I'm going to talk about is the renewable biomass provisions. The Energy Independence and Security Act restricted where feedstocks can grow and be harvested for use in producing renewable fuels for compliance with the Renewable Fuel Standard too. And this is, you know, otherwise known as, you know, the definition for renewable biomass. In the Act, it said that planted crops and crop residue from agricultural land, that ag land needed to be cleared or cultivated prior to enactment, so prior to December of 2007, in order to be a qualifying feedstock. Planted trees and tree residue from non-federal lands and tree plantations also had to be from land that was cleared or cultivated prior to December of 2007. But that's what the Act said. Then it leaves it up to the agency to figure out exactly how we would actually ensure that those provisions were met. And we had a fairly thorough discussion of this in the proposal, and essentially had tracking and record keeping and reporting requirements for all of the renewable fuel producers based on the, to ensure that the definitions were met in the proposal. We got a lot of comment on it. We got a fair amount of discussion about whether what we had proposed was overly burdensome, whether there were other ways that we could actually implement this provision and still ensure that the intent of the Act was met. And so this is again an area that we did a lot of work on between proposal and final. And where we ended up were essentially two paths. One path for the feedstocks from non-agricultural land or forest land, and a different path, different compliance approach for feedstocks that would come from planted crops or agricultural land. The approach for non-agricultural land and forest land is essentially that all renewable fuel producers using feedstocks from this sector have two options. One, they can individually verify and qualify their feedstocks following the specific record keeping and reporting requirements that are in the final rule. Or you can opt to form and participate in a consortium that essentially employs a third party to conduct that verification program so that it's not up to the responsibility of every individual renewable fuel producer. So that's the option, that's the path that we've laid out for the feedstocks from non-agricultural land. We have provided for an alternative path, and this is a new path for the final rule that was not our main proposal for the proposal. So for feedstocks from planted crops and agricultural land, producers can comply under essentially what we're calling an aggregate compliance approach. That means based on our assessment and our analysis and other people's analysis, we don't envision that there will be additional agricultural land brought into production in order to, beyond what had been previously cultivated, in order to comply with these volumes. And therefore, based on that assessment, we are saying that in aggregate, renewable fuel producers comply with this program based on those projections. Now, we have to make sure that we're monitoring that and checking for that. And if, in fact, that does not hold true going forward, then renewable fuel producers will be kicked into the same options that we've laid out for the non-agricultural land. But we think that we've laid out the data, and we think there's sufficient information to indicate that if we certify using this aggregate approach, then the individual record-keeping, verification, mapping, and tracking approach will not be necessary for feedstocks from planted crops. Okay. Another area that we got a lot of comment on, there's a lot of discussion of, is the facility grandfathering provision. So as I mentioned before, there are life cycle greenhouse gas thresholds that fuels have to meet to qualify for each of the renewable fuel standards, again, envisioned in the Act. But for the total renewable fuel standard, which the Act said had a 20% life cycle greenhouse gas threshold, facilities that were currently producing that had commenced construction prior to enactment, and then for other facilities using natural gas or biomass that commenced construction in the 2 years following enactment, those facilities were essentially grandfathered from having to comply with the 20% life cycle greenhouse gas threshold. So all of the volume that was currently under production or about to be produced essentially didn't have to meet the 20% life cycle greenhouse gas. Now, that the Act was fairly clear on that, but exactly What does it mean to be grandfathered? What are the time frames? What does it mean to commence construction? All of those sorts of things that are things that we had to sort out through through the rulemaking process. And we know that that's an area that there was a lot of interest in through the comment period. I also know that that's an area that there's a lot of questions on right now going forward about what that means to each individual plant. And again, this is an area we're happy to work with folks as you go forward to figure out exactly what that means for your individual plant. But what we've done for the final, and it's basically a fairly consistent approach with what we proposed, is that, again, all pre-enactment facilities are grandfathered for the general renewable fuel category. The basic approach is that if you're grandfathered, you're grandfathered indefinitely, but only up to a baseline volume. And that baseline volume is based on a maximum allowable volume that's in air permits or maximum capacity achieved if there's no air permits. We also think it's important to allow for some small tolerance of 5% to account for minor changes due to ongoing maintenance so that folks aren't worried about if they make some small change to improve their plant that they're not all of a sudden that additional volume isn't going to be kicked into the to meeting the life cycle threshold. So that's what we've laid out in the final rule. For volume increases beyond this baseline, just those additional volumes beyond the baseline must meet the 20% threshold like a new facility. Okay, so now that I've talked about what types of feedstocks in the final rule are allowed to qualify and the volumes that don't have to meet the life cycle thresholds, I'm now going to talk a little bit about what we did in the specific application of the life cycle requirements in the Act. I can safely say that this is the area we got more comment than any other area in the rule, and we got lots and lots and lots of comment. And I will say we got incredible amounts of new data, new research, new peer-reviewed studies, new model results, and it was all, I would say it was incredibly constructive. It is very helpful to us through a comment period to get real information and data and science. And RFA and a lot of others and folks in this room made significant contributions to that work, to pointing out what are these assumptions, what is the basis for them, what's different data that can be used, what's more recent information, what's more recent peer-reviewed studies. And I can tell you from my perspective and those of us at EPA, it was incredibly helpful, and it's very important and exactly why we have a public comment process on this. The other thing I want to say is it also recognizes that this is the first time that a life cycle greenhouse gas requirement, and specifically a requirement in the Act to look at indirect land use change emissions, has ever been incorporated in any kind of a legislative or regulatory requirement. That means that people all of a sudden cared about it and spent a lot more time looking at this issue and did a lot of new work. So having that provision in the Act really contributed to the evolution of the science in this area. And there's no question that the science evolved significantly over the last year through this process. And there's also no question that it's going to continue to evolve going forward. This is still a relatively new area and new area that people are looking at, and how it gets incorporated into regulatory provisions, again, is a new thing. And so we want to make sure that we recognize that evolution, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a couple minutes, about how we're going to recognize that the state of this science and this field is going to continue to move forward. Just because we issued a final rule clearly doesn't mean that it's done. It just means it's kind of the first step in moving forward with this. So that being said, we did get a huge amount of comment through the comment period, and we also actually peer-reviewed our life cycle approach between the proposal and final. We peer-reviewed several key aspects of it, recognizing that this was new science, and in many cases we were relying on new data and new models and new tools that hadn't really been used for this purpose before. And so the feedback we got both from the comments and from the peer review were incredibly helpful for informing what we ended up doing in the final rule. So we made a number of updates throughout the life cycle process, certainly in the indirect land use component, but also across the other stages of the life cycle. There was new information that came in, and we wanted to make sure that our final rule reflected that latest information. So we made changes to how we modeled the domestic agriculture sector. We incorporated new results for new sectors. We had new land classifications. We had much more significantly greater detail in the modeling going between the in the final rule compared to the proposal. We made updates to the way we modeled the international agriculture sector, you know, as you might imagine, how we look at the international agricultural sector response to the U.S. biofuels mandate. How we model that becomes incredibly important if you're looking at the emissions from indirect international land use change. So we made a number of updates there, again, based on new science and new data. We also changed the biofuel processing for plants across the board, both, you know, for a variety of different types of renewable fuels. In general, the where we were in the final rule is that producing renewable fuel was more efficient, essentially, in the final rule than where we were in the proposal. And then just how we actually modeled land use change, the data that we based, what types of land the models predicted would be converted in response to biofuel demand in the U.S., got significantly more sophisticated. We had much broader geographic coverage of satellite data. For example, we use satellite data, as I think many of you know, to project what type of land might be converted. We had satellite data from 35 different countries in the proposal. In the final rule, we had satellite data from 160 different countries. We used much higher resolution, much more detailed data. And again, the sources for all of this information came to us either through the comment period or from the peer reviewers who had very specific sources of information that we could use to improve our methodology. Now, because we made changes across the board, some of these updates led to emissions increases in the life cycle. Many others led to emissions decreases. But there's no question that the indirect land use component, particularly the international indirect land use component, was the most significant aspect of the life cycle calculations we did in the proposal. And that there's also no question that for the final rule, those estimates decreased significantly, more than 50, 60, 70% in some cases. That being said, the international indirect land use component is still a significant piece of the final rule estimates for the life cycle calculations. And let me talk a little bit about kind of what some of the key updates that drove those changes, drove that significant decrease in the international indirect land use change component. And many of these came from data, peer-reviewed results, and other modeling results that folks in this room helped point us to in the academic literature that we could then use for the final rule. So I'll just talk quickly, and I'll use corn ethanol as the main example here. In general, significantly less overall indirect land use change we found for the final rule. And that's really based on, I'd say, three different things. The first two led to less land needed. So because of these updates to the models, as a result of increased demand for corn ethanol, we found that there was less indirect land use change needed in response than we had found in the proposal. And those are based on two things. Significantly, we had new studies and new data that showed that the rate of improvement in crop yields increased as a function of price. So this was something we took comment on in the proposal, but we didn't actually incorporate it in our modeling. We didn't allow in the proposal for crop yields to increase as a function of price. We did then allow for that in the final rule because we got both comment that we should, but also specific information on which to base that assumption. There's no question as corn ethanol has greater demand because of the mandate. Corn has greater value for use in corn ethanol, and so then, therefore, there is an incentive to increase yield as a function of that, and so we wanted to make sure we allowed for that in the modeling. That results in less land needed, obviously, if your yields are increasing. The second is that we had new peer-reviewed literature about the value of co-products, and specifically for corn ethanol, we increased the value of distiller's dry grain based on new research from Argonne National Lab as well as the University of Minnesota. We were aware of some of this research at proposal, but it hadn't come out and it hadn't come out in time for us to incorporate. It then was brought to us through the comment period, and so we could update our assumptions based on the latest literature on that. So both of those are reasons why we had less indirect land use change. The third piece is that of the land converted internationally, that land actually in our final rule had lower greenhouse gas emissions impacts. And this comes really basically right back to the fact that we had much better disaggregated satellite data. And again, one of the big things in the proposal is that we assumed when cropland expanded into grassland internationally, that grassland had to go somewhere. And we assumed in the proposal the grassland would go into forest land. For the final rule, we actually had much more specific detailed data that showed that as cropland expands onto to pasture area, that pasture area can actually expand more onto other grassland and not have to go into the forest land. Obviously, if you're converting forest land, you're going to have higher emissions than if you're converting grassland, and that's one of the big things that led to lower emissions internationally for these pathways. So all of those kind of the less land needed because of the price-induced crop yields, the more disaggregated data internationally helped across the board for all of these fuels. There were specific things we changed for each of the fuels as well. We updated N2O emissions for soybean biodiesel, which led to a significant decrease in emissions. And again, we had kind of better disaggregation about where crops are grown internationally that helped lead to the results for each of these fuels. All right. I know I'm getting into a little bit of detail, but I just think it's important that folks kind of understand the road that we've traveled with all of your comments between the proposal and the final. One other big update in our analysis. In the proposal, if you sort of remember this, we had a series of different point estimates for what the life cycle greenhouse gas emissions were for different fuel pathways. And we ran sensitivities and had lots of different assumptions and showed what the impact of the on the numbers would be if we changed the assumption about different things. But in the end, we had a series of single numbers. We were uncomfortable with that because it didn't actually recognize that there is inherent uncertainty in these assessments. They are based on model projections. They are based on projections going forward into the future. They are based on assumptions about greenhouse gas emissions from different land types and the types of land that can convert it, which is inherently an uncertain kind of projection. And so we thought it was important to try to formally recognize that uncertainty. And if possible, given the statutory requirements we had, make our determinations incorporating that uncertainty analysis. So it wasn't really just a single number that was either above or below the threshold. We tried to develop a range based on formal uncertainty analysis and incorporate that range, incorporate that uncertainty analysis in how we went about making decisions. We did continue to make sensitivity analysis. We did continue to do sensitivity analysis. We also think that the uncertainty was narrowed based on use of more recent information and better data, but we also built probability distributions around two of the key variables, looking specifically at the types of land converted, as well as the greenhouse gas emission factors for different types of land. So we actually, in the end, and have ranges for each of the different fuel pathways, and we looked at those ranges in making the threshold determinations about whether a fuel qualifies or not. So what's the bottom line? In terms of the life cycle analysis. Essentially what we've done, said in the final rule, is that ethanol produced from cornstarch at a new natural gas, biomass, or biogas-fired facility using advanced efficient technologies meets the 20% threshold. Bob showed the dozens and dozens of pathways that we've analyzed earlier. We have looked at a number of different combinations, and essentially what we found is that, corn ethanol produced from a clean, efficient plant that we have heard from you all is the type of plant that will be built going forward would qualify with the threshold. We also found that butanol from cornstarch meets that 20% threshold. We found that biodiesel from soy wastes and algae meets the 50% threshold. The algae pathway was a new one. We hadn't done that in the proposal. We did have it for the final rule. The soy biodiesel pathway was a pathway that in our proposal numbers had not met the 50% threshold in the final rule. It now does based on the range of results that we've looked at. Sugarcane ethanol meets the threshold as we proposed it would in the proposal. And then we looked at a variety of cellulosic ethanol pathways and found that of all the pathways we looked at, they result in significant greenhouse gas emission reductions relative to the petroleum fuel they replace and do exceed the 60% and in many cases exceed it a significant amount. We clearly didn't analyze every possible feedstock fuel process combination, but what we have tried to do is extend the results as much as possible more broadly than that. We are taking the approach that you know, for the same fuel type and feedstock as a modeled pathway, the results would extend to you. For example, if we modeled, and I'll just use this as an example, I appreciate it may not be the best one to use here, but we modeled a sugarcane ethanol pathway from Brazil. Based on those results, a sugarcane ethanol pathway of sugarcane produced in the U.S. would also qualify. So we're country neutral here by applying the same results. We also extend to other fuel pathways, which we found had a low risk of non-complying, that we felt that based on what we had modeled, that the same results or better results would hold. So we didn't model every different type of crop residue, but we are extending the results for the crop residues that we did model to other crop residues. And there's a number of other categories like that we have extended the results for. That being said, we know that we couldn't extend them to every possible combination and every feedstock. We haven't analyzed all the different feedstocks, and given the way the Act is set up, we have to make a determination for a fuel to qualify. We also know that there are some feedstocks out there that are already currently being used that we didn't model and that folks are very interested in having us look at. So for a couple of these feedstocks, we're planning to update the assessment and issue another rule in the next several months to issue a final rule. Now, these are for feedstocks that we feel like we have sufficient information on but haven't yet completed the life cycle analysis. There's going to be a number of other fuel pathways that we don't have data on, we don't know about yet, folks that are going forward. And so what we've done, and this is different from what we proposed, we've actually laid out a petition process for folks to come in and tell us, you didn't model our feedstock, our fuel pathway. We think we qualify. We want you to make a determination that we do so we can get credit for the renewable fuel standard. And so we've laid out a petition process in the final rule. There's a list of data and things that need to be submitted to us as well as a little bit on the process. That being said, we recognize that the state of scientific knowledge continues to evolve in this area. And the agency is committing to further reassess this, so not just for the new fuels and feedstocks, but across the board. And in the final rule, we've said that we're going to ask the National Academy of Sciences to do a review of the whole life cycle assessment and the indirect land use change component and report back to us with recommendations. We also know that there's going to be other scientific review processes going on looking at this area, and in general, the state of scientific knowledge is going to continue to evolve. And so we would envision that to be kind of a several-year process that would go in and update this. That being said, we don't want to hold up bringing in new fuels and new feedstocks in contingent on that, what's probably a several-year process. And so because we have an annual rulemaking, we have to set the cellulosic standard every year. What we've said is through the petition process, as people let us know that they've got new fuels and feedstocks and provide data, we're going to roll that into the petition process so that we've got a real regular annual process for reviewing. It may be, though, that somebody just has a change to the process technology, not a new feedstock. It's a feedstock we've already looked at. And we don't think we actually have to go through rulemaking to issue a final regulatory determination for those fuels. And so we do envision some of the petitions we will be able to act on right away without having to go through a rulemaking process. But again, if it's a new feedstock, one that we're not sure what the modeled impacts are, that we think we have to do a rulemaking process, but we have an annual process to do that. Okay, let me just wrap up. I know we wanted to leave at least a couple minutes for some questions and back and forth, but we did, in addition to laying out all of these provisions, provide a fairly detailed regulatory impact assessment. And I don't think the results of this would surprise anybody. There's no question that this rule and achieving the full volumes envisioned in the Energy Independence and Security Act would result in significant impacts in terms of displacing gasoline and diesel consumption. It would decrease oil imports valued at $41.5 billion. We did quantify the energy security benefits of this program, and that we've incorporated that into the regulatory impact assessment. We did assess the greenhouse gas emission reductions, and we think there will be greenhouse gas emission reductions when the volumes are fully realized. And we also looked at the impacts on the agriculture sector. For example, we found that farm income would increase by an estimate of about $13 billion. The other piece of this that we're also required to do is look at the emissions and air quality impacts. And increasing renewable fuels will have impact on emissions. Some emissions go up, some emissions go down. And they vary in geographic areas. And we've got maps that kind of lay out where these impacts are. This assessment that we did for this final rule is not the separate assessment that the Act actually requires EPA to do. ISO directed the agency to further evaluate the potential air quality impacts and to take steps to mitigate them if necessary. We still have to do that. That's a separate requirement of the Act, and we'll move forward with that now that the rule is final. So I know that there's... I'm sure there's lots of questions. I'm sure that not everybody in this room has read the full document. It's a fairly extensive rule. There's a long and a lot of detailed information in the docket and on our website. And I would refer you all to the website for kind of this first point of information about this. We've got a whole system set up for questions and answers for folks who've got specific questions, they can send it to them. Our registration page went live on February 5th, so folks can start the process for registering and reporting. All the forms are up there. We also are planning to have some upcoming implementation workshops. We would hope to work closely with RFA to set those up moving forward to make sure that we are reaching all the people that have questions and we need to reach through this program. So I think I'll stop there. I appreciate your attention on this, and again, appreciate the opportunity to be here and talk about this rule. Thank you.
Is this on?
We have a few minutes. I think during Bob's talk, he mentioned the value of RFA membership. And having now worked extensively on the RFS 1 and the RFS 2, I want to highlight the fact that the RFA team is unsurpassed in putting together comments and providing information to EPA on proposed rules. I work with a lot of different associations, and it's not often that I get phone calls from EPA saying, well, what does Bob think? And I get those from EPA constantly because Bob has the credibility and the knowledge that they're looking for. They don't always agree with Bob. He'll be the first to tell you that. But they do want to know what he thinks and what his staff is thinking of the rules they're putting together. And on the points that Sarah just went through, on almost every one of them, we engaged with Sarah and her team a good back and forth on how to implement this program. You know, the examples being, you know, the renewable biomass. You know, when it was first looked at, this was an obligation now that goes to you as producers to identify. You have to be able to demonstrate that you're using renewable biomass. Well, that's a daunting task. Are you tracking the kernels of corn all the way back to the field that qualifies as renewable biomass? And we needed a different system. EPA heard us. And maybe, Sarah, just go over again, because I think it's pretty important how you landed with kind of an aggregate compliance for at least for cropland on the renewable biomass.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key point here is for feedstocks from agricultural land, we did hear that the record keeping, the reporting, the individual kind of verification approach that essentially we had laid out in the proposal was going to be overly burdensome. And so we worked closely with RFA, with others, with USDA particularly, to try to find kind of some alternative way to do that that wouldn't require every renewable fuel producer to individually map and track where their feedstocks came from, because we heard overwhelmingly that that in many ways wasn't really possible. So again, what we've said is, and we're kind of making this determination up front, is that in aggregate, based on what we're the projections we're seeing about whether there's new cropland being brought into production, that we're not seeing that. We're not seeing new cropland being brought into production as a result of this program. And so we're saying that renewable fuel producers who are using feedstocks from agricultural land in aggregate comply with this program, and so there is not this requirement to do the individual mapping and tracking of where the feedstocks come from. And that's kind of the bottom line. Now, it is something that we're going to have to track going forward to make sure that that is the case, and that as we kind of look back in subsequent years, if the data provided by USDA is showing something different, then we're going to have to revisit this. But again, I think that takes a significant burden off of the individual renewable fuel producers.
Yeah, I really see this as a very significant improvement to the proposed rule in the final. Maybe speak for a second just about some of the new reporting requirements. The RIN system, I think, you know, people view it as having worked pretty well, and now we're overlaying that with some additional, you know, reporting on RIN pricing and production outlook. What's the agency's perspective on the need for that information, the use for that additional information on pricing and production outlook, and also efforts to ensure confidentiality?
Yeah, no, we recognize that this is, concern and sensitivity. And I can say that I think we've got a good track record, I'll let you guys correct me, for keeping information confidential that is necessary for providing the information that's necessary for transparency, but also to make sure that the program can run going forward. The best thing I can say is that these are questions that I encourage folks to. I don't want to put them on the spot, but we've got Tony Miller and John Wyrock coming tomorrow morning for a session specifically on the tracking system and the data that needs to be provided and things like that. And so, I encourage folks to listen to that presentation tomorrow morning and have a better sense of kind of how we do that, how we ensure the confidentiality, how we preserve the information, but also have the information necessary for compliance.
All right. I need to ask this question, otherwise Bob's going to tackle me when I leave the stage, and I don't want that to happen. Life cycle, there are many interesting aspects to it and controversial aspects to it, but one result in the final rule that was puzzling to some of us was the sugar ethanol, the land use impact in Brazil from corn ethanol in the U.S. seemed to exceed the land use impact of the production of sugar ethanol in Brazil. And that seemed odd to us. It led to a fairly significant increase in the beneficial aspect of sugar ethanol. Maybe a explanation or a comment on that?
Sure. I mean, let me first recognize that the land use emissions component, the indirect land use emissions components for all of the fuel pathways that we analyzed, including corn ethanol, including sugarcane ethanol, including biodiesel, went down significantly. So we made changes and updates to the model, the price-induced yield updates, the co-product changes, all of those things that, I would say specifically price-induced yield components, led to significant decreases in the indirect land use emissions for all of the fuels. So all of those, that component went down. The other thing I'll just note is And I know, it, you know, there's a lot of information and a lot of data, and you kind of have to dig it apart. And again, we're happy to help folks understand what we've actually got in the record as we move forward. If it's not entirely clear, but for the final rule, the land use change, the acreage change per gallon of sugarcane ethanol is actually higher than the land use change per gallon of corn ethanol. However, what we've got are lower emissions per acre for sugarcane ethanol than for corn ethanol. And that's kind of what you're seeing, I think, in terms of the results. It's not actually that there's lower acreage change for corn ethanol. In fact, for sugarcane, in fact, it's the opposite. We're actually seeing less acreage needed for corn ethanol indirectly than for sugarcane. But what the emissions are for that land converted ends up being lower for the modeled pathways for sugarcane ethanol. That being said, again, both pathways qualify. The indirect land use component is down significantly for both. And you know, consistent with the proposal and other analyses, that kind of relative difference between sugarcane ethanol and corn ethanol is still relatively consistent to where it was before.
I think we have a whole other panel coming in after the break, which we're already infringing on, and that will get into this and